We've taken our WLTD microphones out to sunny California. Oh, pardon me, sir.
Yes?
Can you tell me where I can find Frank Nelson?
Who can I?
You are Frank Nelson.
Yeah, I think I am, Jack.
There is no doubt about it anymore. What a familiar sound that is.
Well, we did it for, I did it with Jack for 37 years, so that's kind of a long time.
37 years? Mm-hmm. When was the first time you worked with Jack?
I worked with Jack, first broadcast I ever did with him was in June of 1934.
No kidding.
Uh-huh, that's right.
Oh, my God.
That's, at that time, he was a five-minute insert, doing a five-minute insert for an Eastern show, and they had a little sketch where he was coming to California, and he meets this fellow on the train, and he's telling him what a big shot he is and how he's going to California, and he's going to do great things out there. And he says, you know, you're a very personable young man. He says, possibly I could do something for you. He says, my name's Jack Benny. What's yours? And I said, Clark Gable. And that was the opening sketch that we did.
And you were a regular with him all along, huh?
Well, I started out, I guess, in the first year or two, just doing casual things with him here and there. And then finally it grew into a regular character, and I was with him for many years under contract.
We lost a great entertainer, didn't
we? Yes, we did. Yeah. We lost a fine man, too.
Let's go back before that first appearance on Jack Benny's show. And what was your first professional appearance? Was it on radio? Or
the first thing that I did on radio was in 1926 in Denver, Colorado. And there was a bank there that was going to do a 13-week series. And so they held auditions at KOA. And I went out, just a kid in high school at the time, and I went out to KOA, and this man looked at me, and he said, oh, he said, you're much too young. He said, this is a 30-year-old man. I said, oh. I said, well, they told me to come out. And he said, well, have you ever read on a microphone? I said, no, haven't. I've done theater. And he said, well, as long as you've made the long trip out here, maybe you'd at least like to read. So I had a deep voice then, and so I read. And there were some 30 of us, and when we got through, the next day they called back 12, and the following day they called back 4, and the following day they called me and told me I had it. Now, I never understood the part, but I played it. That was my beginning, and then I worked with KOA on various shows, and then I announced for KFEL, which was a smaller station in Denver. And then I decided I was going to make my fortune come out to Hollywood. So I came out here at the end of 29 and started with Georgia Fifield out here in Hollywood, the Georgia Fifield KNX Players. Mm-hmm. And that was my... I had a letter of introduction to this lady, and I went over to KNX, and I'm standing looking through the window, and there's a very cute redhead inside with twinkling eyes, and she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I winked, and she winked, and I found out that was Georgia Fifield. She's living over in Hawaii now.
She's not winking anymore.
No, no. Oh, she probably is, if I know Georgia.
So then you got it. You came to Hollywood. Have you been here ever since?
That's right.
You've done occasional work on the East Coast, I assume.
No, actually, I have not. The only thing I ever did in New York was a Jack Benny show.
And, when he went to New York.
That's the only show that I ever failed to complete in my radio career. I've gone in on a stretcher, and I'm not kidding. I actually did that in Denver in that early series. I got pneumonia, and they took me out on a stretcher to play it 1 week. But the only show that I ever actually missed through illness or anything else was the second broadcast of the Jack Benny Show in New York City. So that's my Eastern career, one half of what I was supposed to do.
Well, when you were first in Hollywood then, and you worked with this gal who, with the twinkling eyes, let's go down the line.
Well,
we
did so many things in those early days. We did a show called Makers of History down at KFI. It was written by Jerry Cady, who went on to write for 20th Century Fox, and a very good, prolific writer. We did Tapestries of Life, which was... about the statuary at Forest Lawn, and that's really the way I started back into freelance radio. I was doing announcing at KMTR, and I got a call to go down and do a very highly dramatic thing called Father Forgets, which is a father talking to his son by his crib while he's asleep and apologizing for all the bad things he's done, as we all do to our children, and how we yelled at him and so on. And so it was very dramatic, a tearjerker. And I did it in the middle of a comedy show, and they got a tremendous response from it. And at that time, the fellow who was doing Tapestries of Life was having a lot of trouble. He was getting his tongue wrapped around his teeth a lot, and he was fluffing a lot. And so Jerry Cady called and said, look, would you be interested in doing these Tapestries of Life? And at that time, they paid a lot of money for local radio. They paid $10 a piece, which was a big, big fee, because you were working for two and a half, three, five was fairly normal. Few seven and a halfs, but ten was big money. So I said, gee, I'd love to. So that started me back, and then he gave me Makers of History, and so I was making $25 a week down at KFI, and I got out of the other job. As a matter of fact, I got fired from the other job as a wedding present, which was...
Why?
We had a fellow at that time that owned that station who was just a little bit sadistic. As a matter of fact, the FCC finally said he couldn't own any more radio stations because he was kind of a wild man. But anyway, I did various things around town here. One that was a very popular local show was The Witch's Tales. And Paula Winslow, who was another gal from out here, and I did the leads in those for, about 2 years. That was the most envied show in town at that time. Now, this was before there was any transcontinental Nettle shows out of here. And then finally, I had worked for John Swallow at KFAC KFVD as an announcer, and John became the first head of NBC out here. And NBC at that time was just an office on the RKO lot, on the back lot, and we worked on sound stages initially, and then they built some sound stages strictly for radio right at the end of the RKO lot. But that was the beginning, and they had a show out of here called the Hollywood on the Air show, which was the RKO show. First show out of Hollywood that was transcontinental, but it was not sponsored, except that RKO, really, it was their sponsorship, in effect. And I used to do everything on that. I was the announcer. I filled in as a bit actor. And then if somebody didn't show up, I played that part, too. And... did that for about, about a year and a half. And then the first transcontinental show that was sponsored out of here was an original Marx Brothers show with Groucho and Chico, just the two of them in it. And I did that. Georgia cast the show, and she was their secretary, and I was regular on the show. And as a matter of fact, I could have been in movies if I could have sung. Because one day the boys used to talk about me, but they'd talk in Jewish, so I didn't know what they were saying. And they'd chat, and they'd look at me, and I knew they were talking about me, and I didn't know what they were saying. And so finally, one day, Groucho walked over, and he said, look, Frank, he said, can you sing? And I laughed. I said, sing? I can't even carry a tune. And he says, oh, that's too bad, because what they had me in mind for was the, you remember the Donkey Serenade?
Yeah.
You remember the gentleman who did it?
Yeah,
well, that's right. That's exactly what they had me in mind for in that picture. And if I had been able to sing, I'd have at least had a crack at it, you know. And, of course,
and he would have killed his career.
Well, I doubt that. He was much too fine a performer to have his career killed. But I was working with him at the time, and they thought it'd be a good idea to have me in the picture, I guess. So those are the very early days, and I used to have a running gag with John Swallow. I thought that eventually the big movie stars were going to bring radio out here, that is, transcontinental radio. And John never believed it, never believed it. And I said, you know, John, someday, really, we're going to have a lot of big-time radio out here. He said, not a chance in the world. And so we had a running gag between us when they finally had the... studios at Sunset and Vine, the big NBC studios, and I walk down the hall and see John coming up the hall. I say, John, ever think big-time radio come to Hollywood? Nope, don't think so, Frank. And we never changed it in all the years we knew each other.
One of the great running gags.
Yeah, just kept it going. But they were fun days, those early days. They were great days. I think radio offered so much more to an actor than television does, because... you could do anything that your voice would allow you to do. You weren't trapped by what you looked like, how tall you were, how old you were, or how fat you were, or anything else. You could just do anything that your voice would allow. And that let us play a great deal of varied types characters.
And you didn't need any time for makeup and
no,
costumes.
Oh, that
and
was
that
nice.
Stuff.
That
yeah.
was nice. And you read it, too.
Yeah.
Although that wasn't as easy as we make it sound now. Yeah. Lots of times we look back and we say, oh, boy, what a soft touch that was. How easy it was. But it wasn't easy. It truly wasn't. You had to come into a studio and you had to create a character in a very brief period of time, and it had to be believable, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And all those characters weren't the greatest in the world, but it kept you on your toes, and it kept you working hard. And we did things, funny things that you'd do. I remember I had a show at NBC, which is really one long block from CBS, and I had it at the last studio in the hall. That is the closest studio to the CBS studios, and I would conclude that show, sign that show off, and then run out the side door. I'd have a page there. He'd have the door up, and I'd run out the side door, tear across the Palladium lot, and slide through Studio A. They had a big double doors there, and they'd have that open for me, and I'd slide through to the middle of the stage and take one deep breath and say, ladies and gentlemen, from Hollywood, and open the next show. And I tell you, some days I thought, I'll never get the words out. I wouldn't want to try it now. But I was a lot younger then.
Well, that's when everybody really had to run around. You were, you know, you didn't have any long-range contracts.
That's right.
That's right.
Oh, yes, you were, well, some, there were contracts, but not too many. You know, an awful lot of it was freelance. And I did shows where I'd say, well, I can't make any of the rehearsals. What's the part? It's so-and-so. I'd say, well, if you want to mark the script, I'll come in and do it. And actually go in and do it on the air for the first time. But it was a comedy show, and it was, you know, the gags and things that you at least were easy with and familiar with. But so it wasn't quite as easy as sometimes we make it sound in retrospect.
We're so familiar with the character that you've played and I'm sure created on the Jack Benny series, yet he wasn't always the man behind the railroad counter or the floor walker. He was always some
Jack
kind
always
of a
referred to him as his nemesis.
Nemesis.
He says, well, the nemesis character, because I played a variety of things, but they were all the same fella. And he never had a name, like Mr. Kitzel, you know, had a name and so on, but if he ever referred to him by name, he just called me my name, Mr. Nelson. And,
that's right.
So many people, I'd meet people on the street, you know, they say, hey, you're that fellow on the Jack Benny show. I say, yeah, what's your name? Because they really didn't know you.
Yeah, but it was really familiar. Now, you worked on some of the biggest network comedy shows, too, doing other things.
Oh, sure. I was in the Blondie show. Uh-huh. I was the
neighbor.
Next-door neighbor, Herb Woodley.
Herb Woodley,
sure. I was regular on that. And I worked with Cantor. I worked with just about anybody you want to name in the comedy field. I worked with at one time or another. I mean, I wasn't regular on all those shows, but I worked them all.
Whenever they needed a good comedy foil,
used to have a standard thing. You'd go in and the writer would say, now, be as funny on this show as you are on the Jack Benny show. And I always said, you write it as funny, and I'll be as funny, because I'm just as funny as the material. And that's as funny as I am. But
you were with Parky Carcass, too.
Yes. I was regular with Parky. I did a running character. I can't even remember the name of it now. It was not a long series. It didn't last long.
Mm-hmm.
And Parky, of course, unfortunately, had an operation that wasn't successful, and he ended up in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. Had a back problem.
Well, how did you land these shows? You know, you get a job with Jack Benny, for example. Do they just come to you?
Actually, yes. No. In the days, in the later days, you just got the calls. Now, I'm not saying all actors did that, but I never went out after jobs. I didn't call directors to say, why don't you use me on your show or anything like that. In the very early days, back in those earlier days that I was talking about when I was doing the $5 shows and the $3 shows and that type of show, then you kept a little book boy and you knew exactly when that director cast and you'd call him up. You knew whether to tell him a joke and hang up or whether to ask him for a job or what to do. And I was famous for my little black book at that time because I knew them all and I knew how to approach them. And you had to do that then because you were fighting for very little money. And if you didn't go around and see them and remind them you were alive, you just didn't get the calls. But as the business got bigger and there were more people listening to the shows, more people would catch that show and say, hey, well, why don't we use him next week, and mm-hmm. so on. So I think that's the way our calls came, mainly in the later days.
When you, I'd like to find out what it took to put on a Jack Benny show.
Jack Benny show was really quite easy to do. I'm talking now from the actor's standpoint. Obviously, the writing was meticulous. Jack honed a lot of that writing. He sat with the writers a great deal. Mm-hmm. He, if it came down to a rock-bottom decision as to a joke in or out, it would be very often Jack's decision that made uh-huh. that uh-huh. happen. And but for an actor, it was a very simple show to do. You'd go in, we'll say on Saturday, you'd read through once. Just sit down, read the script straight through, get up and leave, and you'd come back in on Sunday. You'd read once around the table, go and read it once on the mic, and that's all until showtime. And it was just that easy to do.
So the whole thing was really right in there with the writing.
It was that, man. And also that Jack knew his people, and they wrote for those people. Mm-hmm. And Jack had a great thing that I don't think any other comic in the business had. If you were to pick up a Jack Benny script and read it, you'd say, well, wait a minute, where are Mr. Benny's jokes? Because Jack didn't do jokes. He did looks, he did takes, he fed, really, you, the actor around him. That's the way he conducted his show. The big jokes were in the hands of the people who surrounded him, which was most unusual. And it showed that he had tremendous confidence in himself, because there were a lot of, I could name one, and I won't, but there was one man who was very famous as a comedian, and when you would do the dress rehearsal, if you had a big joke and it got a big laugh, when you came back to do the show, you didn't have that joke. He had the joke. And very often he couldn't understand why the joke didn't play on the show like it had in the rehearsal. And the reason was it was built for you and it wasn't built for him. But he never learned that lesson. But Jack, on the other hand, had no such insecurity. And so he gave those jokes to his people. He surrounded himself with characters that people expected to hear also. When as soon as he said, "Oh, mister," people said, oh, boy, here it comes. He's going to get it, you know?
Yeah.
And if he said, excuse me, and the fellow said, see, he says, oh, boy, here it comes.
Yeah.
Now they're
yeah.
going to do that routine. The people were in on it, and I think they enjoyed being in on it. And I guess the fact that the show stayed on top all the years that it did proved that.
How long was he on? How long were you with Jack on radio? Through the whole radio time?
Through the entire radio time, yes. That, of course, as I say, was just an insert on an Eastern show. But from the time he started his show out here, I worked with him. I did not work regularly right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I worked just spasmodically. But after about 2 years, I guess, I was pretty steady. We'd do 39 shows in the season, and I'd usually do, anywhere between 25 and 30 of those shows, so...
That's pretty regular, yeah. You made a nice, easy move into television with him then.
Yes, well, television came along. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to go with it. I'd kind of wish this business were still here. And I kind of think it would have been if we hadn't had the same people in charge who were going to be in charge of television. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the networks.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the ad agencies. Because I think then you'd have seen a big fight between the two. I think they would have each fought for their share of audience. And I believe today there is a very definite place in this country for good radio. You know, a lot of people in the big cities think, oh, well, I turn on television, I've got 7 channels to choose from, as we have here, more than that, I think, in New York. But there are many parts of the country where they can't even get television, and many parts where they have their choice of one. And I think that radio gave them a great deal more than television in those areas, certainly, but... I guess the networks aren't much concerned about that because they're making more money this way.
Well, you see, radio is in itself an art form,
yes.
If you want to get real heavy about it, but it should be able to provide the public with comedy and mystery.
That's
and
right.
Drama,
there should stories. Be a great deal more variety than there is today. Today, we have talk shows, we have news, but we're the kind of things that we did in radio before. They're gone. Although there's some slight resurgence, I don't know whether it'll... really last, but I would like to hope that it might.
You'd like to do something on radio regularly today?
Sure.
I bet you do a great job with it.
Well, you know, once in a while, we still have a show out here that's done for the Salvation Army.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes we don't have the most magnificent scripts that ever came down the pike, but it's fun to go and do it. Because
it's a heartbeat theater.
Yes. Once again, at least you're doing a radio show. If you want to hear yourself, you got to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. They get, you know, real good time slots.
Yeah. The CBS Mystery Theater is doing...
Yes, that, of course, is a different cup of tea,
yeah.
And they're making a real effort, and I understand that the response to that has been very good.
Excellent, yeah.
Yeah.
They've gone a second year on it, so that's...
So they just might... we just might get a certain portion of it back. How much, I don't know.
We can hope.
I think the cost factor is what keeps them from going heavily into it.
What else did you do on television?
Oh, well, I did a lot of the I Love Lucy shows, and... My Favorite Husband, and Benny's specials, of course, and his regular show while it was on. I have not worked as heavily in television as I did in radio. That was really where I did the overwhelming majority of my work. I still do commercials. I do one for Harris Trust and Savings.
You are Hubert the
Harris Lion. Sure, I've been Hubert for I think 11 years now.
We hear a lot of Chicago area listeners would be happy to hear Hubert the Harris Lion.
You know, let me tell you a story about that. It's a funny story. I got off the train. I used to travel by train. I'm a trustee of our pension welfare plan.
Uh-huh.
And I used to go in New York by train. And so I'd have about 3 hours to kill in Chicago. So I was walking uptown one day, and I thought, I'm going to go see that bank that I've been doing this thing for a few years now. So I walked in, and I'm standing looking around, and some gentleman came up and said, could I help you? And I said, no, I just want to see the bank. I do Hubert the Harris. He says, you do Hubert? I said, yes, stand right there. And I thought, what did I do? What's going to happen? He's gone. A few minutes, down from the PR room comes the PR man. He says, you are Hubert the Harris Lion? I said, yes. He said, come with me. Takes me upstairs into the PR room, and there are 20 people around at typewriters. He said, ladies and gentlemen, the voice of Hubert. And they all stood up at their typewriters and applauded like this. I got hysterical. He says, have you ever seen any of the commercials? And I made the mistake of saying no. And he said, and now he calls, and they get a projectionist, and they project these things, and I sit and look at him. And then he said, Mr. Harris is retiring today from the bank, and he would just be heartsick if he didn't meet you. I want to see if he's still in the bank. And he called, and he was. We went down in the elevator and across and up in another elevator, and then it looked like a C.B. DeMille set, because here are these great marble columns. Way at the end of this is a desk, and a little old gentleman is sitting behind the desk, and went all the way down there, and it was Mr. Harris, and Mr. Harris was just finishing with somebody, and he got up, came over, shook my hand, they called a photographer, came up and took pictures, and the greatest routine I ever saw in my life, and he was just delightful, and it was just unbelievable. I got back, and I said to my agents, you know something? I've been doing that show too cheap, I'll tell you that.
You did a personal appearance and you didn't even know it, huh?
But it was so funny to go through all this. But they were just thrilled to death.
You do a lot of commercial work, don't you?
No, I don't do a lot anymore. I used to do quite a bit. Uh-huh. Yes, I've done quite a bit in the past. But now Harris and very little else.
Just taking it easy.
Yeah. Well, we've been traveling a bit, my bride and I. And she likes to travel, you see. So she's gotten me into Europe, and she's gotten me into New Zealand and Hawaii, and I think maybe next it'll be Africa. So
really?
Uh-huh.
You're going to give them the old, do I?
I think she's going to feed me to a lion when she gets me over there.
One last thing I want to talk to you about. The cinnamon bear.
Oh, that's another funny story. I had a gentleman write me about that, and he said, you're in this. And I wrote back, and I said, no, I'm not. And the reason I said I'm not, I went to the trouble of going to my books and going through it, because I've kept books ever since I started back into freelance radio in the 30s. So I read through every one of these things right up to today, and I said, no, I did not ever do such a show. I said, yes, you did, and also... your wife's former husband was in it, Hanley Stafford. And I said, I asked Viola. Viola said, no, he didn't do anything like that, I'm sure. And so finally the gentleman sent me the tapes.
Mm-hmm.
And I played them, and sure enough, there is Hanley. He's the crocodile, and
and
I'm Captain Tin Top.
Captain Tin Top, yeah.
And then it dawned on me, why? This was back before AFRA came into existence, and Glenn Heisch, who was a close friend of mine and did a lot of the shows that mm-hmm. I did down at KFI, I figured out, must have called us and said, hey, fellas, I got this thing that I want to do, and it doesn't pay anything, but would you come and do it? And I'm sure that that's the reason for it, and that's the reason it's not in my book, was because there was no fee attached to it. And so they decided they were going to reissue this, and they have now. And AFRA made a deal with them, and I want to tell you, 2 years ago, for my performance, I think I got $1.86, and last year I got $1.43, and next year I'm looking forward to 85 or 90 cents.
Well, see, it just keeps you traveling. That's Well, you should go to Maybe Land then on when Soda Pop fuel in the Magic Airplane. That was a great series.
It was
though.
A cute,
beautiful
cute show,
story,
cute
yeah.
show. And some of the, we've sat, I figured out some of the people, he thought I've forgotten who he thought was on it, and I said, no, that's Cy Kendall. I think he thought it was Lou Merrill, and it was Cy Kendall, and various people I was able to pick out. But the one person we have never been able to figure out is who the little boy was. To this day, we don't
Jimmy.
Know. Jimmy.
Jimmy, Judy
that's
and
right.
Jimmy were the two.
Judy right. was Barbara Lee Wong. Little girl that says she's still teaching school out here, and she did it, but she can't for the life of her remember who the boy was. And I've gone through in my own mind, and I've asked the young fellows that have grown up around here, and not a one of them remembers doing it. So
isn't that an interesting thing, though,
that
it would have been, you know, and it was a greatly well-loved serial in Chicago. I mean, it played year after year after year, department store sponsored it, and it was
well. I got this letter first from this gentleman, and got the tapes, and they were very bad because very hard to hear, not good copies. And then our national exec wrote to me, and he said, "Do you know anything about the Cinnamon Baron?" I wrote back, "I said, are you putting me on now? Come on!" And then I told him the whole story about this, so I helped fill him in on this, and they wanted to make a deal on it of some kind with AFTRA, and so they did. Actually. Strangely enough, it was very nice of the gentleman who was involved to make the deal, because actually that series was made before the union was in existence, so he had no responsibility to pay anything to anybody on that particular series. I can't say the same for a lot of the stuff that's floating around.
That's right, yeah. Well, you've been part of so much of the stuff then and now, and you've been great on it, and there's a lot of people out there who want me to say thank you for all of the fine performances you've turned in over the years.
Well, that's very kind of you, Chuck. It's been a gratifying business to be in, and it's given me a lot of pleasure, and I'm glad if it's given other people pleasure, too.
If you were to get a job on another kind of a Jack Benny program, and he says, can you spare some time to work in it, what would you say?
Ooh, can I?